Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It is spring, but it feels a little like summer in California. If you have a garden, you might already have spent time outside putting plants in the ground or tending to them. But with all the news about record drought over the last few months, are you thinking differently about how you'll water your plants in your yard this year? Has water availability affected your decisions about what you'll plant this spring? Or have you considered alternative systems like gray water? Today, garden experts are joining us to talk about the benefits of natives, drought-tolerant landscapes, and the best practices for saving water and growing your own food. And we want to hear your tips, too. I will give you the number in just a minute, but let me welcome our guests. Daniel Miller is the executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project, and that's a nonprofit based in Berkeley, Southwest Berkeley, designed to create healthy, sustainable communities by promoting a strong local food system. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm always thrilled to be here.
We're delighted to have you. We're also joined by phone by Kathy Kramer, who's the organizer of the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour, which showcases native plant gardens in Alameda and Contra Costa counties that are pesticide-free, conserve water, provide habitat for wildlife, and contain 60% or more native plants. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Kelly Marshall is a professional landscaper in the East Bay. She specializes in creating beautiful California native and low-water garden designs for our climate. She designs between 30 to 50 gardens a year. And welcome, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
Delighted. Okay, so I'm going to start with just a quick lightning round for all of you, sort of 60-second quick tips for gardening during a drought. Daniel, you want to start us off?
Sure. And my specialty, especially in this interview, is going to be about food gardening. And so first, I want to encourage people that food gardening is a very valid use of water. And you can grow four times the amount of food and use half the amount of water than if you're getting it from the Central Valley. So please do water your food gardens. Other than that, watering deeply when you do water is really important.
So what does that mean?
Well, you know, when you want to use less water, it's not about how much you water when you water, but how often you water. Because watering deeply creates a zone of water below the roots that then the roots can go down to and tap into. If you don't penetrate very deeply into the soil, you'll actually need to use more water in the long run.
All right. So from Daniel, grow food. That's a good use of water.
Yes.
And water deeply. Kathy, how about you? What's your quick tip?
Well, half of the water that we use in our homes is applied to the landscape, and the most of that water is applied to the lawn. So the best way that people can conserve water is to reduce the size of their lawn or even go out and eliminate their lawn. And if they use a drought-tolerant native plant garden, they'll use half or less of the water that they would have used before on their gardening.
All right. And Kelly?
I'm completely 100% in agreement with Kathy on anything is better than a lawn in terms of water usage in your landscape.
So get rid of your lawn.
Absolutely. And I mean, some people can't quite let it go. So if you can't let it all go, then reduce or consider an alternate carpeting of green that uses less water.
And Daniel would say, put some food in it, right?
That's right. Yeah, get rid of those thirsty ornamentals and grow food.
All right. Well, let's hear from you, Kathy. You organized the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour, and this is the 10th year of the tour. Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
How do you define a native plant?
A native plant is a plant that has been here for thousands of years. It was a plant that was here before Europeans arrived in the 1700s. Native plants are adapted to our climate in California. They're adapted to our 7 months of dry weather and 5 months of wet weather. So they did perfectly well before we came along with our extra water and fertilizers and pesticides, and they do very well, you know, with very little care in the garden.
And how is a naturalized plant different than a native?
A naturalized plant is a plant that has been brought here to California, and it can do well here, and it can reproduce and spread here. It's not native here. So eucalyptus is a naturalized plant. They're all over the place. They do well here. They don't provide good habitat for wildlife. Ivy is a naturalized plant. Junipers are naturalized plants. There are lots of naturalized plants here in California, but they don't provide the habitat for wildlife that native plants do. Even if they're easy to care for plants, they're still, really, they're not as valuable in the ecosystem as native plants are.
A friend of mine says her gardening store is recommending African drought-resistant plants. Are there non-native plants that do well here and don't require much water that you recommend, or are you really just pro-native?
There are other plants from the Mediterranean climate around the world, South Africa, the Mediterranean, that will do well here in California. California is also a Mediterranean climate area, but California has the coldest low temperatures of the Mediterranean climates, and it has the highest high temperatures of the Mediterranean climates. So native plants will do even better than Mediterranean climate plants. But people who can't, you know, embrace the idea of all natives can certainly include Mediterranean climate plants or food plants in their gardens. They would still save less water, and they could still eliminate or reduce the pesticide use by doing so.
And Kelly, why are lawns so thirsty? Why do they take so much water?
Well, if you think about it, there's a lot of work and water and chemicals that go into a perfect lawn. Lawns don't look very good without an awful lot of water, chemicals, and care. So I think what happens is people move here from other places, and where they've come from, and I'm from the Midwest, I get it. It rains every week in the Midwest in the summertime. So a lawn might be a little more appropriate for Indiana, but it isn't appropriate for our climate, and we don't have the water to keep them looking good. So without all those extra things, they don't look good, and people, I don't know, for some reason take pride in it looking fantastic and are willing to use excess water and chemicals to make that happen.
And you once heard a professor say that there will be wars over water someday, and that kind of got you focused on drought-tolerant landscaping, right?
It did. I don't remember a whole lot else from that class, but that line has stuck with me for 10 years. I just can't forget what he said. It influences everything I do in my design work.
And Daniel, you focus on getting people to grow their own food.
Yes.
In a drought, does that become harder?
It becomes more expensive.
Uh-huh.
Is the main way it's going to affect most people is the water quotas that then, you know, after a certain amount of water usage, you're going to pay more. So that often will cut down on your savings from growing your own food. So, you know, I hardly recommend you think of every other way that you can reduce your water usage. There are ways to reduce your water usage while food gardening, and hopefully we'll get into that later in the show. But there's so many other ways that we use water that are so much, we can so much more easily cut down on, you know, like I never wash my truck, you know,
makes me look, wash your car.
You know, it makes my truck look terrible sometimes, but I can't justify running that water onto the curb. And I'd rather put that into my soil.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Do you talk to people at water districts, though, about how do we encourage people to have gardens instead of penalizing them for it?
Right. It's tricky. And one of the main things I've talked to them about is the way that water is metered. If you can get an irrigation-only meter, it saves you a ton of money. When water is metered to you, not only are there water quotas in drought, but you're actually paying a sewer fee for every gallon of water that you use.
Yeah,
and
tell
even
me about it.
Even though you may be putting on the soil and the sewer is not involved, you know, so if there's some way to look at someone's property and the ratio of land that they're using in their irrigating and then not charge a sewer fee for that amount of what they're using, it would help a lot. And that's one of the things that makes using water expensive is paying a fee that's not even using when you're irrigating.
That's Daniel Miller. He's executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm also joined by Kathy Kramer, who's the organizer of the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour. She'll tell us about that in just a minute. And Kelly Marshall is a professional landscaper in the East Bay who focuses on drought-resistant landscapes. And we're putting together a toolkit for gardening in a drought, as increasingly this Northern California is. And if you want to join our conversation, the number is 866-798-2400. talk. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Do you have a garden? What are you planting this spring? And do your decisions around what to plant revolve around how much water those plants need? How do you water your plants? How are you saving water? Give us a call and let us know. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you're somebody who has a gray water system in place to water your yard or your garden, I'm really wondering how that's working for you. How did you install it? I'm thinking of trying to do this myself, so I'm looking for tips. 866-798-TALK, and you can join our drought conversation here on Your Call. So, Kathy, tell us about the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour. How does it work? It's free and self-guided, so how do people connect with it and navigate through it?
Okay, well, people can go to the website, which is www.bringingbackthenatives.net. And it's a free tour. We ask for donations, but nobody has to pay if they don't want to. People can register online, and they need to register before April the 26th when online registration closes. Then there's a section on the website that says View the 2014 Gardens. So people can click there, and they can see all the 35 gardens, a list of the 35 gardens that will be open on Sunday, May the 4th from 10 to 5. If they click on a garden, say somebody lives in Oakland, Berkeley, Moraga, if they click on the gardens that are under those cities, they get they can see photos of the garden, read a description of the garden, look at plant lists, wildlife lists. So they can find out a lot about that garden by looking online, and then they can plan their route for the day.
Got it. Okay, and we'll put a link to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. There will also be information about all of our guests there. And Daniel, you talk about, you know, really trying to encourage people to grow their own food. And you said that there are other ways that we can be saving water so that we can use that water for food gardening. What are some of the ways that you recommend for people to conserve water?
Well, in the household, there's all kinds of ways, and I'm not really the expert on that, but most people know those things. There's low flush toilets. There's, you know, if it's yellow, let it mellow. That's the old one from the 70s that I grew up with.
Yeah, I remember our last drought well.
You know, there's low flow shower heads. There is gray water is a great one. Catching the water while your hot water warms up and using that, the water from steaming your vegetables is actually really good for your garden. So you can do that. There's all kinds of ways in the household that, you know, is commonly available ways to save water that way.
And yeah. A caller who couldn't stay on but is a longtime drought-tolerant garden designer says that eucalyptus and juniper have become very important habitat for native birds and non-native bees and are therefore valuable. Does anybody want to speak to that?
Oh, I would disagree. I just saw a photograph of a bird with a gummed-up. It was a songbird with a gummed-up beak. So when they peck into the eucalyptus, the sap from the eucalyptus gets on their beaks, and there was this big, you know, pile of gum on its beak. So really the best habitat for wildlife. I mean, one could argue, you know, one can argue about that. Certain things certainly have benefited monarch butterflies like eucalyptus trees, but the best habitat for wildlife is provided by native plants, and research has shown that native wildlife prefer native plants to non-native plants when they have access to them.
And Kelly, you've said that I believe it's easy to have a low-water sustainable garden here in California if you choose the right plants to begin with. So what do you think are some of the right plants?
Well, I'm a big proponent of natives as well, and I agree again with Kathy. And Daniel, I grow food too, so I don't want you to think I don't appreciate the food that we can grow in our soil as well.
And I grow native plants as well, so.
Okay, so we all love each other.
Yes.
Everybody's
so
in sync.
I have to agree. If you want wildlife in your garden, there is no better way than having native plants in your garden. And they happen to be beautiful and appropriate for our climate, and many of them use a lot less water than traditional plants that you'd find on the shelf at Home Depot and places like that. There are great low-water plants from other Mediterranean climates. I love Australian plants, South African plants, Mediterranean plants. You know, lavender is an old standby that's great for bees and is fairly easy to grow, and it smells good and it looks good, you know, 11 months of the year. So there are many choices from many climates. getting them more known to the public and getting them on the shelf in places where people can see them and have access to buy them would make a big difference.
Anything that you want to add to that, Kathy?
No, except I want to say I also have 14 kinds of fruit growing in my backyard. So I have the combination of fruit trees, and I have my natives bring in the pollinators that help increase my fruit set.
Well, let's take a call from Lucia from Hollister. Hi, Lucia. Welcome to your call. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Hi. I called. One of the suggestions, my tip, has already been made. I want to elaborate on it. I collect the shower water when it's, getting hot. And then I use it to water my roses, water my plum tree. And then in the rainy season, to flush a toilet.
And so do you just collect your shower water in a bucket, or do you have an actual gray water system?
No, it's just in a bucket. I can't afford the gray water system right now, but just in a bucket.
That is a valid gray water system.
That is a valid gray water system. Good point. Well, thank you, Lucia, for that. Talk to us about doing some of these kinds of things. Like what second use water is good for a garden and what shouldn't you use? Yeah, Daniel.
Well, the main restrictions come around hygiene and health protocols. Almost any water from the household, as long as it doesn't have detergents and bleaches and stuff, is good for plants, but you have to be careful about introducing bacteria to edible systems. So that's where the protocols come around. And if you want a detailed explanation, I would go to graywateraction.org. They're a really good group in the East Bay that helps people with this, and they have a website with all the ins and outs of it. But basically, if there is question about hygiene, bacteria, generally it's the water is sent to ornamental plants in your landscape. And it takes the cleanest water that being sent to your actual garden. Sometimes there's a filtration system before that to make sure that the water is purified by the soil. The soil has a natural action of sanitizing the water that goes on it. It's just about the water contacting edible parts of plants that you might eat later. So, from the bathtub, for instance, even if you're using good soaps, there is some, possibility of introducing fecal matter and things like that. So that's where the caution comes in. But that water will grow plants very well. You just have to learn the ins and outs of where you can put it in your garden, how to pre-filter it through different reed systems. Or, I've seen bathtubs with gravel and sand and rushes in them, and the water goes into that first, and then it goes into your garden, and so on. But I recommend going to graywateraction.org for a full rundown on it.
And we'll put a link to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about gardening in a dry climate, and we want to invite you to join our discussion. We're at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you're a farmer, urban or rural, and you're growing food or crops, has the drought changed your planting plan? And if you have other tips or questions about gardening during a drought, give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. And I'm joined by Daniel Miller that you just heard from. He's the executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. Kathy Kramer is the organizer of the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour. And Kelly Marshall is a professional landscaper in the East Bay. We're putting together a toolkit for gardening during a drought. So if somebody is, say, living in an apartment in San Francisco, for example, or in Santa Cruz, and doesn't have a plot of land, what kind of recommendations do you give to urban gardeners for what to plant, maybe if you're doing it for the first time, Daniel?
If they don't have land, generally, some people will do it on patios or windowsills and make small container gardens. if some people have the possibility of doing rooftop gardens, and then the next option, of course, is extending out and finding community gardens in your area, or if there isn't one, starting one.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there's
wait lists for the community gardens here in San Francisco.
There are, but there's also still lots of land that's not being used, so that's always a good way to do it. And it could be something small. It could be, you know, a little bit of unused land in front of your neighbor's yard that they don't want to take care of. There's the curb strip. There's plenty of places to garden. And then, of course, what you plant depends on where you're actually getting the plant. If you have to do a container garden on your windowsill, you're going to be planting small, shallow-rooted thing, herbs like cilantro or, you know, maybe some parsley. Whereas if you have an actual plot of land in the ground, the options open up quite a bit more.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, and if somebody wants to take over a medium or something, how to actually do that and what you recommend that they plant. But let's hear from Sarah in Santa Cruz. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to your call.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say that we got our 4 water barrel catchment barrels from the city.
Oh, in Santa Cruz.
We boosted that up by going and buying about 32-gallon buckets from the hardware store. And so we've saved up, just in the last couple of storms, almost 1,200 gallons.
Wow, that's great. And so the city is giving them away free as an incentive?
Not free, at a discounted price. I think they were like $30 each, and they're really nice. And it's really easy to do, and you would be surprised how much water you could get off your roof.
So you just put the barrels up onto your roof? Tell us exactly how it works, Sarah.
No, the you make the gutter go into the barrel, and the barrel fills up, and then there's a hose that comes off that barrel that you put into a bunch of other barrels, and you kind of link them together.
Wow, that's really cool. I haven't seen that before. So do other cities have these barrels for people to get? Does anybody know? Kelly or Kathy?
I don't know which cities, but I do think some cities offer that.
And you can just go to a hardware store and buy them, as Sarah did, if not, right?
Yeah, or you can look online for big systems that you can install as well to capture your roof water.
And just put them under your gutter. Yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
Alameda County was offering very reduced prices on rain barrels, but they had the demand was so high, they actually had to stop it for a while. I don't know if it started up again or not. I'm trying to remember the exact name of the agency, like Alameda County Wastewater Management or something like that. They were offering these giant rain barrels at really cheap prices, and I just missed by a day when I could get one. But I would caution people. I think it's great to save rainwater. If you're getting it straight off a rooftop, I've seen simple devices in permaculture handbooks where the first few gallons off your rooftop are diverted so that it can actually get rinsed first before you save up the rest of that water, because during the long period of the non-rainy season, a lot of pollutants can accumulate on your rooftop, auto exhaust and soot and so on. So I would try to hook up a device, or maybe just not hook up that rain barrel for the first rain and let your roof get cleaned off first.
Okay, that's a good recommendation. Yeah, go ahead.
The best way for people to find out, I don't know of any programs going right now where rain barrels are discounted. The city of Oakland had one for a while, and Alameda County had one for a while, and those have both ended as far as I know. But people should just go on to their water district's website and look under conservation and see what they're offering. And I wanted to say that on Saturday, May the 3rd, there'll be a talk on gray water gardening. It's a free talk at East Bay Wilds Nursery.
Great. And we'll put all of that information on our website. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're just about to go to a short break, so I apologize. We're joined by Kelly Marshall, who's a professional landscaper in the East Bay. Kathy Kramer is the organizer of the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour. And Daniel Miller is executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. We'll take more of your calls after our break. We're 866-798-TALK. And give us your tips on gardening in a dry climate. 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Call here on KALW San Francisco. We invite you to join in today's conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Or you can post your question or comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. There's also an email inbox if you'd like to send an email. It's feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, it's Ira Glass and This American Life.
For those of you joining us now, you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Tomorrow we'll have a conversation about growing up Muslim. What does Islamic identity mean to kids in America? Hana Baba will be hosting that. Friday is our weekly media roundtable. We speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news, and we're going to focus on coverage of veterans. And today we're talking about how you garden during a drought. We're exploring strategies for gardening using less water. Some landscapers advocate taking out water-guzzling lawns and putting in drought-resistant native plants. Are you planting your garden differently this spring? Give us a call and let us know how you're doing it. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And you can post comments at our website where we have all the information about our guests and the native tour. That's at yourcallradio.org. And why don't you, Kelly, give us your best argument for converting your lawn to native plants?
Well, each of you should check with your local water district. Out here in the East Bay, both of our water districts, Contra Costa Water District and East Bay Mud, are offering their cash for grass programs. So they're paying you, the homeowner, or you, the commercial business owner, by the square foot to get rid of your lawn, your water-guzzling lawn, and replace it with low-water landscaping. What could be better?
Cash for grass.
Cash for grass. What could be better than that? And if the water district's paying you to get rid of it, you better believe they think that we should be conserving more than we are.
And Sue from El Cerrito couldn't stay on the line, but she says, don't forget the animals in this drought. Keep your bird baths in your garden. What other tips do you have to make sure that we're taking care of the wildlife around us?
Well, native gardening is a very good way to do it. Let's take a ceanothus bush, for instance. Once it's established, it doesn't need any water at all during the dry season. In fact, it often does better without it. Yet it gets covered with these blue blossoms that are an absolute haven for bees, both domestic and native, and all kinds of other pollinators that we're not even necessarily aware of most days. So that's just one example of how planting a bush that needs no water can feed hundreds, if not thousands, of insects that then feed the whole ecology.
And how are natives better for pollinators, Kathy?
Well, research. For example, one of the gardens I have open on the tour is the California Native Bee Garden in Berkeley. It's only open on the day of the tour, Sunday, May 4th, one day a year. And Dr. Frankie is an entomologist at Berkeley, and his research has shown that native bees prefer native plants like 3 or 4 to 1. So if you plant native plants, you'll have native butterflies, native bees, native birds coming into your yard because they expect to find the food, shelter, and nesting areas and material that have been here for thousands of years. That's what they're looking for, and if you provide them, wildlife will come. I have to say, I also have a pond, and since I put in my pond, we've seen 25 species of birds in our yard here in a little lot in San Pablo.
Mm. And let's go to more callers. Let's go to Mary from Berkeley. Hi, Mary. Welcome to your call.
Hello, my name is Mary Owens, and I'm recalling information context from a class taught by John Villamas, who was a professor at Cal and a Fulbright scholar, who was teaching in the 70s during the 2 7-year droughts. And the soil structure is negatively impacted by gray water. It operates at 10,000 atmospheres. Those atmospheres are usually seen in outer space, but the soil capillary structure creates those atmospheres. And he did not recommend using gray water at all in the garden because of all of the elements that are in the gray water, fibers, etc. And also, it's very important that the soil is moist when you dig it, because if the soil is too dry, it cleaves the soil particles at angles that don't promote ionic absorption. And also, I've heard that our debris cans, in which we're putting all kinds of materials that aren't supposed to be introduced into the soil, are actually not allowed to use that debris in agricultural fields at all.
When you say debris cans, you mean garbage cans?
We mean, in Berkeley, we have debris cans where you are asked to put in all of your paper materials with foodstuffs on it from restaurants, etc. And that I've heard that that material, when it's taken to whatever disposal sites, is not allowed to be used in agricultural areas, and I believe it's because of the soil structure issues. So
all
that's
right.
My comment. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Does anybody want to speak to what Mary's talking about, and particularly not using gray water or the dangers of gray water?
Well, I haven't heard of what she's speaking of exactly as far as the atmospheric pressures and stuff. I mean, gray water can be applied at a trickle, so I'm not sure how that applies, but you definitely have to be careful about what's in the gray water. If there's a lot of detergents and such that can be harmful to soil life, also even the biocompatible detergents tend to be very alkaline. It's not always, you can't just freely use it. You need to learn more about what you're doing to use it, unless you're applying it to other parts of the yard. You know, there are a lot of native plants that do grow in more alkaline soils and so on. As far as using the green waste, actually the Grover Corporation that does it in Berkeley, at least for Berkeley, managed to get theirs certified organic. Now, there are people who claim that there are persistent organic pesticides in it, and I want to learn more about that. I know it is used a lot by gardeners in Berkeley. They make it available for free every fourth Friday down at the marina, and yards and yards and yards of it get used. So whether that organic certification that they've managed to achieve for it actually means something or not, please let me know.
And that's Daniel Miller. He's executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call, and we're talking about gardening during a drought. Daniel says the best use for water is to plant and grow your own food. I'm also joined by Kathy Kramer, who's the organizer of the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour. We have a link to all of that information. It's May 4th this year, and that's at yourcallradio.org. And Kelly Marshall is a professional landscaper in the East Bay. Let's go to more calls. Andrew from San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
So I'm calling in because there's a comment about accessibility to land in the city and the wait list for the community gardens. I have a community garden spot at Treat Street Commons. It's at 23rd in between Treat Street and Folsom in the Mission District. We run it a little bit differently there. I have my own little half spot, but then we have about 6 or 7 beds that are open to the community. So I am inviting any individual who would like to get their hands dirty on Sundays. I'm there from 11 until 3:30.
Fantastic.
And the added bonus to that is they'll get to see something called the Free Farm Stand, which is a volunteer-led organization that distributes free food collected at the various farmers markets and within the city limits of San Francisco. And the goal is to demonstrate abundance.
And so, Andrew, your garden is at Treat Street and what?
Treat Street, 23rd and Treat.
And you'll be there on Sunday, and you're calling all Mission dwellers to join you?
Yep, 11 to 3.
Fantastic. We'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for calling in. And that brings up the question I had earlier, Daniel, which is, okay, so if somebody wants to start a community garden or take over a median, how do they do it? Give us a little toolkit here.
Well, we should do a whole show just on that because that's a big one. The first part is where. It's identifying where you want to do it. And then you can look up at the county tax assessor's office who actually owns the land. Now, there's different models for it. There's land owned by corporations, there's land owned by private people, and there's land owned by city or
like a median.
like a median, or like the land that we actually use at Spiral Gardens. It's an old railroad right-of-way that we tested was clean. We went through a two-year public process to do it. And it's public land. It's owned by the city of Berkeley, and it was disused for a long time. And I actually, that's my strongest thing I advocate for right now, because private land, if you don't own it yourself, you're never really in control of it. And, you know, I'm not a big advocate of temporary gardens, because you invest so much, you know, improving soil is so much labor and work and materials that you get attached. And if you plant any perennials, any fruit trees, so on, that investment needs to carry on. But public land is our commons, and it combines well with the fact that a lot of municipalities don't have enough money to take care of their land anymore. So the public-private partnership is a really good model right now that I advocate for. Of course, it takes a lot of work. It takes a community process to open public land, but that's even better, because in that community process, you get neighborhood engagement in the land, which you need to do anyway. And the best tip I have for that, the why we succeeded in having access to the land at Spiral Gardens, is we went to the neighborhood first. And so we didn't encounter NIMBYism, not in my backyard, when we finally took it to city council and the city agencies, because we had screened it with everybody first. We asked them what they liked about it, what they didn't like about it, what they'd like to change, how they'd like to participate. And so by the time it made it to actual government to get permission for it, we had everybody with us on it.
So it's a real exercise in community building as well.
Which is what community gardens are all about. It's about cultivating community and the public commons, as well as cultivating plants.
And that might be one of the solutions as places like San Francisco are changing so much because of this new gold rush. That might be one of the strategies for bringing people together. Start a community garden on public land. Let's go to more callers. Let's go to Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard. Do I have you there, Richard?
Yes, hello. How are you?
Great, thank you. Tell us...
Okay, I got a couple of things for you. First, I just came into the program. Did you guys talk about mulching?
We have not talked about mulching yet, so go for it.
The single most important thing you can do, about 2 inches of mulch, it will cut down on water use by up to 80%. It will keep the soil temperature even. It will cut erosion when you do water. It will stop new weeds coming in and smother out old weeds very often. It's just got to be done.
And when do you mulch?
All year.
All year.
I do it all year, but you've got to do it in the spring, through the autumn, in the dry season for sure. And eventually, if you use the right kind of mulch, you can dig it in later, you know, and let it lie fallow for a while. We use straw sometimes, but also alfalfa is terrific. I'm in the community garden at Fort Mason, but I've got this other thing I want to tell you about. What I do now with all the plants that require deep watering and that are not good with overhead watering because they tend to develop mildew, such as tomatoes, zucchinis, cucumbers, for instance, I put two or three plastic bottles in the ground with their neck level with the top of the mulch. I put two or three little pinholes in the bottle facing the plant. I put one halfway up and a couple at the bottom. Pinholes, not big drill holes, just small holes. You can do it with a heated needle or a very tiny drill. And I just fill those up about once a week. It delivers the water right to the bottom of the plant and on the way down. It encourages deep root growth. It uses up these hideous plastic bottles that we've got everywhere. And also you can add your liquid fertilizer into the bottle, and it's just so simple, and there's virtually no, and I would say no evaporation happens because it's in the bottle. It just works for me like a charm, and last year my tomatoes were the best ever, and I'm going to do it now this year on all of my susceptible to mildew type plants. It's not good with things like carrots, obviously, and root crops, but it works great with those sort of single plants that require deep watering and that are susceptible to mildew.
Fantastic tip. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
Richard, really appreciate it. Richard brought up mulching, Kelly, and you do workshops on what you call sheet mulching. Can you tell us what that is and how it works?
Yes. For those who are ready to reduce or eliminate your lawn, you have multiple choices to get the lawn out, but we are, Kathy and I are big proponents of sheet mulching. So that involves using layers of cardboard or newspaper down right on top of the lawn. Think of it like a lasagna method. That's kind of what we call it when we do it. The cardboard, or we use cardboard in our workshops that we're teaching, but you could use multiple layers of newspaper. You overlap the cardboard or the newspaper so that you cut off all the light to the lawn. We trench along hard edges like sidewalks and driveways. So we do a small trench, maybe 6 inches back from the hard surface and 3 or 4 inches down. We run the cardboard down into that little culvert so that we have a nice clean edge against whatever hard surface we're running up against. And then that also, that little culvert acts as a catch basin for the mulch that we use on top of the cardboard. Sometimes we add a layer of compost in there depending on what we're going to plant when the lawn is gone. Sometimes we don't. It depends again on what plants you're planning to use at the back end once your lawn is gone. But we've been leading these workshops. I don't know, Kathy, you did 4 or 6 last year. We have several on the calendar for this year, and the interest has grown tremendously in that as well, as a sustainable way to get rid of your lawn and use that land for something more purposeful.
And we'll put links to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's go to Greta in Oakland. Hi, Greta. Welcome to Your Call.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Thank all your guests for a great program. My comment is, one, I wanted to put a plug in for native grasses. I feel like that's what was pretty much here in this area, originally, and they're very easy to grow and drought tolerant, and they're beautiful, and you can even get, as a replacement to your lawn, you can get a native sod. So you can install sod that's composed of native grasses and I think make sure you prepare the soil so that there's good drainage. But anyway, so that's one, number one. And two, I wanted to say that as far as native plants are better for wildlife, I think one issue is species diversity, that there's a lot of species of wildlife, butterflies, bees, that are specific to very small number of host plants. And when those host plants are no longer available, the species becomes extinct. So I think it's preserving the biodiversity. If we only want to have 2 species of butterflies that will feed on plants that you can find everywhere across the country, that's what we'll be left with if we don't.
Well, thank you for that, Greta. Another plug for native species. And David writes in and says, Oasis claims their product is okay for water drain to a food garden as long as they are not root veggies. They further claim that their formulation actually feeds vine trees and plants. Is this true? Oasis is a laundry detergent. Anybody know about this? Can anybody answer, David? I think you've stumped our panel there, David. I apologize. Oh, wait, Daniel. Daniel's rising to the occasion here.
Yeah, no, I'm not necessarily stumped. I just was letting other people have a chance. Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm sure anything that's biodegradable breaks down into things plants can use. But any detergent, even if it's biodegradable, still needs to be used in moderation in a food garden.
And Daniel, you talked about the fact that, you're a big advocate of planting your own food. You say that's actually a way to conserve water.
Right.
What are some ways to conserve water in your actual garden?
Great. Well, the mulching idea was brought up, and mulching is fantastic. It really does conserve a lot of water, and it improves the soil and the soil life. With a caveat, when we started Spiral Gardens 20 years ago, we sheet mulched everything, and then we put all our seedlings in, and the next day they were all gone. So mulch also creates
birds.
A habitat for slugs, actually. Slugs and sow bugs, mainly slugs, which are one of our worst predators of gardens, slugs and snails, but the slugs actually live in the mulch. So ways around that are maybe waiting to mulch until your seedlings have got larger and you have hardier plants that are less susceptible, or else I've used crushed oyster shells that you can get from feed stores right around the seedlings to keep the slugs off of them. Or there's a product now called Sluggo, which is based on iron phosphate. It's an actual organic slug and snail control product that you can put around. So, but if you just use mulch in your vegetable gardens, you will lose a lot of stuff to slugs. But the thing I brought up in the beginning is increasing the penetration of water into the soil.
The deep watering.
So cultivating your soil first. In most of the Bay Area, we have really heavy clay soils, and it's really hard to get the water to penetrate beyond an inch or two into the surface. So you don't have to go crazy and double dig everything, but you do have to fork that soil and add a lot of organic material.
What does double dig mean?
That's a method where you dig twice as deep as your tool can reach. It's advocated by John Jevons and the biointensive method, where you take out a layer of soil and then dig the layer below in this like successive trenching method. You can do that. That's a great way to initialize your garden, but you should cultivate initially and add that organic material so the soil can get in deeply. And then when you do water in the way that you water slowly over time to really get that penetration, and check your penetration, because in that way you can train your plants to grow deeper roots and need less water in between.
All right. And let me try and squeeze in a couple more callers here. Let's go to Penny in San Luis Obispo County. Hi, Penny.
Hey, I'm so glad you took my call. Thanks so much for doing the show. This is totally awesome. I just wanted to let all your listeners know my family has actually been trying to promote native plants for about the last 35 years. And my dad, who actually just passed away last month, just wrote a huge website, 15,000 pages, about California native plants and how to use them. And there's so much free information there. You can actually type in your zip code. It'll give you a plant list, conditions for your garden, and how you want to do things in your garden. It'll sort through our database.
So, Penny, do me a favor. When you're finished, stay on the line, and we're going to get that website from you and put it at yourcallradio.org. Okay? Sorry to catch you off.
Awesome.
Go on.
So, anyway, I loved how some of the callers were talking about wildlife. One of the things people miss is, yeah, they might be saving water by putting Mediterranean plants in, but having native plants, you are putting the bottom of the food chain in pretty much, and you're going to have so many pollinators and birds, which if you do have a food garden nearby, too, you'll have higher pollination and just huge jumps to the environment that you're helping.
Well, thank you. So stay on the line, Penny, and we're going to grab your website. Let's go to Scott in El Cerrito. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks very much. Just a little tip on saving water, since that's what you seem to be all about, and thank you for all your great callers and great comments they made. One device no one mentioned in the house is there's a device, a foot pedal, that you can install. Actually, plumbers should probably install it, at your kitchen sink.
Oh,
that's cool.
And so you just set your to whatever temperature you want it, and then your device on the top of the sink, the faucet, but you turn it on and off. There is, and it has like somewhere between 40 to 45% savings of water. If you think about your use at the sink, how much goes down the drain as you turn away, you come back, and that faucet is on full blast. The other item.
So instead of the regular hand faucet method of turning it on and maybe leaving it on, you use a foot pedal so that if you move away from it, it's going to stop the water.
Not even just moving away from it, but just as you're turning and you're standing still in front of the sink, your hands are occupied with the dishes that you're making or the vegetables that you're cleaning, and here you just turn it on or off with your foot. It's a huge saver of water. And the other thing we're saying about using a bucket to catch their water as it turns hot, they should put in a circulating pump at the furthest tap away from the hot water heater. Kind of, you know, and it has a button, looks like a doorbell that goes on the front of your counter. Push it, and it circulates the hot water back into the cold water line, and it has a built-in thermostat. And so when the water gets to temperature, it shuts off.
Wow, that's really sophisticated, Scott. Daniel's nodding his head here.
Oh, I just made me think I want a second foot pedal that also determines whether the water from my drain goes to the garden or not. So when I'm like rinsing a vegetable, I can send it to the garden. And then when I'm using soap, I can let up.
What do you have in your home, Daniel?
My nonprofit work has kept me a renter, and I've had to move several times in the last couple of years. So unfortunately, my gray water system is yet to come.
How about Kathy and Kelly? What do you do? Any final tips here for our listeners?
If you're not using a drip system, if you're still spraying your ornamentals and your edibles, I would highly encourage you to look into a drip system. And when I say drip system, I'm not talking about that what I call the nightmare spaghetti tubing where the little black line runs to each plant. Look into something called NetAFIM, NetAFIM. That is an inline drip system that is extremely efficient, very low maintenance. I use it everywhere in my garden. So it's in my edibles, it's on my hill, it's within all my natives, my Mediterranean garden. That is a way to deliver water deeply but infrequently, as we've all been talking about. There is no waste, and it's from a homeowner's perspective, it's really nice at the back end in terms of maintenance because there is none. So look into that again. NetAFIM, that's a great drip system to consider converting to. Again, not on the shelf at Home Depot, so you may not have ever seen it, but Google it and take a look at it. You can find it locally at professional irrigation places, or Urban Farmer up in Richmond sells it as well.
That's great. And just 30 seconds left for some final thoughts. Should we all be preparing for a perpetual drought gardening plan, Kathy?
Yes, we should. And I would say the best thing people can do is remove at least part of their lawn. And Kelly and I are running two workshops on how to do that, one in April, one in May. And the information is on the Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour website.
And that's all linked at yourcallradio.org. Daniel, you get final thoughts here for our listeners. What tiny tips do you have in 15 seconds here?
Well, I encourage all of us to start living in the climate that we're actually living in and not acting like we're in a place with perpetual running water. But I encourage people to come visit and work with us at Spiral Gardens Community Food Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. Open volunteering, no wait list, Tuesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 11 to 5 at 2850 Sacramento Street in Berkeley.
And all of that information is at yourcallradio.org. All throughout Northern California, there are community gardens. We've been speaking with Daniel Miller, Executive Director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Kathy Kramer is the organizer of Bringing Back the Natives Garden Tour. We'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. And Kelly Marshall is a landscaper who specializes in creating California native and low water garden designs. Again, all of these resources that we've been talking about on Your Call are at yourcallradio.org. You can also post more comments and continue this conversation and tips on gardening during a drought. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What does it mean to grow up Muslim in the U.S.? On the next Your Call, we'll talk with young Muslims about how they integrate their religious practices and beliefs within modern American culture. There are nearly 250,000 Muslims in the Bay Area, and half of them are under 35. So what is it like for these young people to grapple with gender issues, stereotyping, and the social pressures of growing up with feet in two worlds? How much does your religious identity shape how you interact with the world? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Hannah Ababa and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.